Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, and kind of bad/crazy martinis to close out the week. And Ian, I'm sure it's just another lazy Friday around the National Review office. No big headlines being made by National Review. Nothing stirring the political pot with less than 2 weeks
the
first votes of the year. No, absolutely not. Against Trump, an entire issue with about 24 essays explaining from all different parts of the conservative spectrum why Donald Trump cannot and should not be the Republican nominee for president in 2016. Rich Lowry, your editor, was on Megyn Kelly's The Kelly File last night on Fox News, explaining this in a couple of different ways. First of all, some of the warning signs about why Trump's not a real conservative. Here's what Rich said.
If you truly are a conservative, you believe in ideas and principles. It's not just attitudes. It's not just who you dislike. It's limited government. It's the Constitution. It's liberty. Those are the things that truly make this country special. And they are basically afterthoughts to Donald Trump. He almost never talks about them. And if you're truly a conservative, you have a consistent record. We all change our minds on a few things every now and then when the facts change. But he has been on the other side on big, hot-button, defining issues like abortion, gun control, taxes, and even immigration.
Megyn Kelly then pointed out that Trump says he's like Reagan because Reagan used to be a Democrat. Then he changed his mind. And Lowry said, no, well, actually, he marinated in conservatism for decades. He didn't just walk in one day and said, I'm a conservative, elect me president. And then Rich talked about what he thinks the Trump view of the presidency probably is.
He seems to believe what this country needs is a really effective strongman to make the trains run on time, mm-hmm. when what we really need is the government to be cut down to size, restored to its rightful role, and then focus on the really important things.
And the blowback has already begun. I'm sure you'll get plenty more from the Donald's Twitter account, Ian. But the Republican National Committee has now disinvited National Review from co-hosting the debate in Houston in late February. So you're right in the middle of all this. So give us a little bit of an insight into what's going on at National Review and what went into this issue.
It's very simple. There are people already saying this is exactly the type of thing that's going to crystallize Trump's support and Trump supporters will matter and all the rest. But the defining idea behind this issue and behind the effort of all the people, and we've got about 20 contributors ranging from obviously our editors to John Podoritz and Bill Kristol and R.R. Reno, the editor of First Things, and Mark Halperin. You know, this is across the board, across the spectrum of conservatism. The defining idea is we have a tradition that we're defending. We have principles and ideas, just as Rich said, that are worth making a stand for. And it's not necessarily the goal of National Review or any of these contributors to be operating like a super PAC. Our interest is not in running hit ads against one candidate or another, but in laying out a case that these are the ideas and principles for which we stand, that we've stood for 60 years. Here is the leader of the Republican primary field, and he doesn't stand for any of these things. And so it's time to draw a line. We'll see where, you know, what difference this makes, but the point is we have to plant a stake in the ground, and that's what Rich and the editors have done, and that's what all of these contributors have done. And Trump's response last night, of course, was to say, no one listens to, no one cares what National Review thinks. Of course, he said that in a hastily arranged press conference at 11 p.m. right after the issue appeared online. So, you know, obviously influential enough still to prompt that kind of response.
Well, let's move on to our second good martini. And in addition to the offices of National Review, not much work is getting done on the East Coast today because everyone's prepared for this massive blizzard, which, of course, is apocalyptic in nature only because it's where the media live.
Exactly.
In New York and Washington. If this was the forecast for the Midwest, it's obviously a pretty big storm, but it would not get nearly the coverage that it's getting because it affects reporters. Those in Washington have pretty much abandoned the city, with the exception of a couple hundred thousand pro-life supporters who will be marching from the White House to the Supreme Court today because it's the 43rd anniversary of Roe v. Wade. It's 58 million estimated babies that have been killed since Roe v. Wade in 1973. The theme this year is pro-life and pro-woman go hand-in-hand, a direct rebuttal to the Democratic and pro-choice argument that if you're pro-woman, you have to be for abortion rights and that sort of thing. So, Ian, kudos to those folks, not only for braving the elements, but for year after year and really day after day going out and defending those who can't defend themselves and doing so passionately. And one of the most important things that can be done in our country.
Absolutely. The March for Life is an enormous event, an enormously important event. I had the privilege of participating a couple of years back, and you know, walking from the mall down to the Supreme Court where it wraps up. It's truly special. And one of the extraordinary things is it's now been going on for 40 years. If I remember correctly, the largest annual march that takes place in the United States, anywhere from, I think the year I participated, they said somewhere between 300 and 400,000 people. I mean, this is just a massive, massive event, and it gets no coverage, none whatsoever. There is an absolute and total mainstream media blackout on the March for Life, and it just points up the extraordinary disconnect between the center of gravity on the issue of abortion and the way that it's covered. But nonetheless, you still get several hundred thousand people out there marching every single year in sub-freezing temperatures because they passionately care about this issue. And I think it's the work of all those marchers. It's the work of the people who are the organizers and the leaders and all the rest. That is the reason the pro-life movement has gained so much traction over the years, the reason that you have record numbers of pro-life laws going into effect in the states, a record number of pro-life bills being proposed at the federal level, and the reason that 86% of the country, 9 out of 10 people, favor abortion restrictions, and that number is increasing, and it's moving backward, and the protections are expanding. So enormous kudos to them, and it's good work that they're doing.
Ian, you mentioned the media blackout from the March for Life. It'll be fascinating to see what happens this year in particular, because government's shut down. You have to be out of your office by noon, which is when the March for Life starts. So there's literally nothing else for people to do who work in the media in Washington than to cover this march, because nothing else is happening other than waiting for the storm, which will probably be the story that knocks it out of the headlines. But nobody is seen around official Washington at all today, except for hundreds of thousands of people on this march.
Right.
And you really have no excuse to ignore this year. But of course, if objectivity were in play, it would be a huge story every year. So on to the bad/crazy martini now. And, you know, the Obama administration, Ian, has taken so much grief from people suggesting that they just aren't that serious about fighting terrorism, that they're not doing all they can to defeat ISIS and to protect the homeland from people sympathetic to ISIS from invading. Hard to see where they get that impression from when you have folks so passionately arguing against the proliferation of terrorism. But Secretary of State John Kerry was over in Davos, Switzerland, and spent some time with CNBC, who was concerned about some of the money being freed up for Iran through sanctions relief getting into the wrong hands, i.e. the hands of terrorists. And here's how that exchange went.
Do you believe that any of that $55 billion ends up in the hands of terrorists?
I think that some of it will end up in the hands of the IRGC or of other entities, some of which are labeled terrorist. To some degree, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that every component of that can be prevented. But I can tell you this. Right now, we are not seeing the early delivery of funds going to that kind of endeavor at this point in time. Mm-hmm. I'm sure at some point some of it will.
Yeah, I'm sure it will at some point. And it's only been a week since the IAEA gave the clearance. So the fact that it's not pouring in there right now is not exactly the greatest assurance. But he went on to say, Ian, just to be fair, that he's not worried about the proliferation of terrorism, even if a lot of money goes into that, because the defense budgets of the Gulf states dwarfs the military budget of Iran. So he has nothing to worry about.
Yeah, because, you know, that coalition of Gulf allies that we've got, you know, has been so strong on all these, you know, issues of terrorism in the Middle East. I mean, this is extraordinary. Last Sunday, when they unfroze the first assets, they unfroze $1.7 billion. It's, I guess, reassuring, if you like, that that first $1.7 billion wasn't, you know, dropped on the doorstep of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, but they're looking to unfreeze more than $100 billion, I think around $150 billion in frozen Iranian assets. This to the largest state sponsor of terrorism in the world. This is just unreal. Put this in context. Last Sunday, when the Iranians oh so graciously released four American hostages in our prisoner exchange, three Americans were kidnapped in Sadr City in Iraq. That is an area controlled by Iranian-backed Shia militia. There was no way that happened without Iranian forces giving the go-ahead. And my understanding is that they now know that those hostages were moved further into Iranian-controlled territory. It's just astonishing for the situation to be what it is and this administration to be releasing this type of money, and then also to be publicly copying to the idea that it is going to fund terrorist organizations. But in the view of this administration, that's all somehow worth it. They somehow think that the good faith, the enormous bending over backward of the Obama administration is all going to be treated fairly and responsibly by the regime in Tehran, and that somehow it'll all work out in the end. The arc of moral history bends toward justice, or something.
You know, they just said that there hasn't been a lot of inflation lately, but the price of a legacy really seems to be skyrocketing.
Oh, touche.
Amazing. Ian, good luck. I know you're going to get a pretty good wallop of weather up there as well. Hopefully we'll all survive, keep our power on, and reconvene soon. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely.
Ian Tuttle of National Review, and for Jim Garrity today, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us, and tune in again Monday, hopefully, for the next 3 Martini Lunch.